Next case, 10-1846, the Columbus Bar Association versus Kenneth Ray Boggs. Boggs.
Madam Justice O'Connor, counsel, rest of the court. I'm not pleased to be here today, as you can probably tell. However, I'm here because I think that the sanction that was recommended by the panel that heard my case was appropriate, even though I'm ashamed of the conduct that got me in front of that panel. I think the board's recommendation is harsh and more punitive than beneficial to me. I wouldn't be here arguing this case if it wasn't a real concern for my clients who, if I do get suspended, will have to seek other counsel and who have trusted me for many years. I think that the cases, I cannot find a single case that mirrors mine or is on fours with all mine, but I did see the cases of some that I reviewed, the Cook case, the Vosburg case, the McShane case, and the Ryan case, and I feel that those cases are more appropriate the kind of conduct and behavior I exhibited. I've been practicing for over 30 years. My first case I had as I got sworn in as an attorney was in front of this court 30 years ago in a case called State versus David Aldridge. I argued that case and lost that, and I hope I win this one. My concern here is that each one of my violations of previous conduct in 88, I think it was, in 2004, were results of, quite honestly, when I had surgery in 86, I had major surgery. I was off work for a full year recovering, and it led to a situation that was unfortunate. The 2004 is after I was diagnosed with diabetes, and quite frankly, my health went straight downhill. And one thing that has, besides potential suspension in this case and the punishment I received, one thing that benefited me was when I met with Mr. Close at his office to discuss the violations and go over the cases. He said I looked like hell. And quite frankly, I probably did because I did not realize because I'd been off my medication for about 4 years from diabetes. And I went, after he said that, I went to the doctor and I was like 400 or 500 and some number. And the doctor has been working with me ever since. We had the hearing this past spring and I still have not been feeling well. So I went back to the doctor and says, you've got to rest me from myself. I don't know what's going on with my body. So I'm now on insulin and I'm still taking pills and diet and all kinds of other things, trying to get my health back. But that's honestly what's happened here. I'm not a bad lawyer. I work my tail off for my clients, and unfortunately, I probably put my clients above my own health, and that's why I'm here partly today. Each one of my violations from the 88 to 2004 and the recent stuff are all different set of circumstances, so that's why it's so hard to try to fashion what you should do to me. I'm not saying I didn't do some things wrong. I did.
Well, counsel, I think what we're looking at here is the pattern that you've established here. And you started out by saying that you shouldn't receive the recommended discipline because your clients will suffer. Yet you're found, you know, to have pursued conduct that, quite frankly, I don't see how it benefited any clients. Your clients were the subject of this wrongdoing on your behalf. Failure to keep your clients informed of the status of their cases, to act with diligence and promptness on behalf of their clients. You deposited unearned fees in advance, and failed to keep your funds, your operating funds separate. I don't understand how you can argue that there's somebody that is going to be disadvantaged by the fact that you're not practicing law.
I do a lot of pro bono work and less what my normal hourly rate is to help people. The two people that are in dispute here, and that's using the facts, the Dodgers case and the McPeak case, I totally disagree with some of those findings because I did a substantial amount of work. I kept them informed regardless of what they claim. I called them every month. She even said I was Miss Dodgers. I spoke to her once or twice a month that she'd call me or I'd call her and kept her up to date. Unfortunately, she did not like the results that we obtained in almost a two-year period. And I advised her in that in a letter after she retained me. You know, we are chasing a ghost, a needle in a haystack thing, I can't guarantee you anything because it's the most complicated, difficult thing if we can't find this person. I was at one time, as a record reflected, able to find her, find the car, and find out that the car had been re-registered after this person had deceased, but we couldn't prove that the Seagraves lady had done anything wrong. We couldn't get anything on a handwriting sample because we can't find Ms. Seagraves to get something in her original handwriting. I had contacted, and the record reflects, Brit Investigation Service, who did a lot of work trying to help me find this lady. We worked our tails off, and we just could not find this Ms. Seagraves to get the results that Ms. Daughters wanted. You know, she says she never got the letter. I know I mailed it. I know it never came back. She said in the testimony on cross-examination, everything contained in my letter representation, the day after she paid me, I sent the letter out saying, here's what we discussed, here's the issues, you understand everything. And that's, in law school, we had a guy named Morgan Shipman teaching up at Ohio State, who I have the utmost respect for. He called it a C-filer, cover your flanks and rear. I wanted her to understand there's no promises being made, because if we don't find this lady, because she's a pillhead, Ms. Dar said she's a pillhead when I was representing her, she said she was a crackhead. The lady goes underground. The drug people, they have a way to move her, and you cannot find them. It's very difficult. I explained all that to her, but once we could find her, we might be able to take some legal action against her, but that's the first step you have to do. On the McPeak case, I think the panel got lost in some of the questioning because he hired me to review his case before it got to a hearing to get his job back with the union and the ODYS. That's why he was hiring me for, and then he wanted me to look at going at a civil rights violation. So I did all that work in anticipation that he'd have a case. I talked to several people and got several documentation and records trying to see whether he'd have a case. When I sat down with him and said, you don't have a civil rights violation, he got upset and started just complaining. But that was way down the road after I worked for several times. He got his job back because I went back through his records where he'd been fired twice before for the same type of behavior, and I contacted his union representative to see if I could represent him in a hearing with the arbitration panel for his job with the ODYS and his union. They refused to do that, but they did say that they would let me help them prepare and work on his case to make sure he had the best chance, because they also told him the same thing I did. You may not get your job back a third time for the same behavior in a short period of time. He got his job back, and then he calls me up, brings a decision, says, I want back pay and benefits. I said, you're not going to get them. They split the baby in the decision. You can read a decision, and you know where the judges, or in that case, the arbitration representative, was going to go. He says, you know, you're not getting everything. The state's not getting everything. He thought that was a fair compromise. I explained to him that if you go to from arbitration, you can file an appeal in the Court of Common Pleas, and here's the grounds for it. You don't have them here. This decision is well-written. You told me to clarify what the evidence was. It's consistent with the evidence that I had developed in preparing this case with the union, so there's nothing else I could do for him. Well, he didn't want to hear that, and here I am. As far as putting money in the trust account, I charge a flat fee for some people because that's a risk that I take and they take. Some people say, I can't pay you more than this. That's all I can pay you in the long run. Will you take my cake? So no one else will take it for that cheap.
Mr. Boggs, have you had... any instruction or courses in proper law office management or IOLTA account management?
Your Honor, honestly, no.
Of our guidelines on conduct for lawyers.
Your Honor, after I got probation in the 2004 case, I was with Pam Maggett, and she mentored me, and she showed me how to do her account. But she doesn't operate. She does bankruptcy. She doesn't do the kind of practice I do, where sometimes with clients, I work for months before I get paid the first cent.
Do you understand that you cannot put clients' money in your personal operating account? It belongs in an IOLTA account?
Yes, I do now. And again,
you didn't understand that in 2004?
Well, Your Honor, like I said, there's some case law that was developing when I was...
Simple question. Did you understand it in 2004?
No. Not until I met with Pam Maggett. And then in 2006, the rules were changed as far as flat fees and what your requirements were if you were taking flat fees, and I didn't catch it. And that was a mistake I made, and that's why I'm one of the things I'm here.
You're suggesting that the penalty of an indefinite suspension, as recommended by the relator, is too severe, and you're asking us to follow what the panel did... A two-year suspension with 1 year stayed,
yes.
And upon return, have a monitor in your office.
Yes, sir.
That's what you want.
Because the courts, as I understand the disciplinary process, is to protect the public and also help the attorneys get make sure that he's doing the right job.
Are you current in your continuing legal education requirements as you stand here?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I did take a course, but it was on computer management and record keeping as far as that, but nothing with the IOLTA. I haven't been able to find a course that they teach at where they say, here's the process procedures that you go through on either flat fees or retainers or how you do all that whole thing. So, again, that's my fault. I'm not blaming anyone. And you just see, I stipulated a lot of fines here because I'm not trying to avoid whatever I have to take. I mean, I'm a big guy. I'm willing to accept responsibility, but I don't think I should be pretty much taken out of the practice of the law, but I also have concern with my clients. You ask any of them. I had some of them testify at my hearing, and also Del Mazzilli, another attorney. I work very hard. My whole life is practice law. If you take my license from me, honestly, I don't know what else I can do. I've only got my two sons and practice law. That is my life. And I'm saying the case law I cite
is... Are you aware of the impact of an indefinite suspension?
Yes, in my understanding, it's basically pretty much 2 years, and you have to apply to get reinstated, and that may take 6 months or however long, or you may not get reinstated. And I understand. I'm 56 years old. I just had a birthday a few weeks ago, and I had surgery 2 days before my birthday, so I understand, but I want you to understand, I'm not a crook. I do care about these people. I don't, you know, and I, you know, sometimes they'll call you up and says, give me my money back, or I'm going to go to the Bar Association. To me, it's like extorting me when I did nothing wrong. I worked for this lady from January of 06 to I think it was August or September of 08. If she had a problem, why couldn't she call me up, come in my office, and I'd show her the reports or have her meet with the investigators? And then in my points I put out in my brief, you can see where she admitted all these things. Yes, she talked to me about her brother. We kept in touch with her. We avoided anyone. There's no reason to avoid a client who has a question that they want answered. I believe in it. I believe in the profession, and I believe in the process, and that's why I'm here. If I didn't think if I was a crook, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't waste my time or waste yours. I love my clients, and that's what I work for. And, you know, I asked Mr. Close when I met with him, do you think I'm a crook? He says, no. You just need some business practice management. And that's the bottom line of it. And, again, I'm sorry for the situation. It's very humiliating. If I do get suspended, one of the first people I have to call is my mom. Explain to her what the situation I'm in because of basically my stupidity and not being able to watch my health. I've got my doctor monitoring now on twice a month to go in for checkups, and I watch my blood sugar daily. I'm doing everything I can to do that. I've got a new system where I put files together, checklists for every file, so when I take a new case on, everything is going to be by the book, and I don't have any problems. I look at the rules, whether they change or not. I look at them every month to make sure I'm on top of the situation. I'm making the adjustments. I just hope that you understand I'm not a crook, and I don't want to hurt anyone. I live by the golden rule, and I believe in that wholeheartedly. And I also believe that, like my dad told me, your word is your bond. If your clients can't trust you, if your family can't trust you, if your friends don't trust you, then you don't have anyone that can trust you. And that's not how I operate, and I'm sorry to be here, and I'm sorry if I've taken up too much of your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Close.
Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Boggs, please the court. I don't believe, as he said, that he started out to be a crook, but that's what ended up happening. Ken Boggs served, or arguably served, unsophisticated clients. I give you the address that these people's come from, and you'd know exactly what I talk about. These aren't people from Arlington and Dublin and Hilliard. And these were people with substantial personal problems. Miss Dodders, for instance, was living on disability. Mr. Peacock was unemployed. They come up with substantial amounts of money. Mr. Boggs took that money and immediately put it in his operating account and did nothing. I am offended by his comment that she could have called me. The record is replete in these transcripts of these clients calling again and again and again and again and again. His voice box is full. His office is closed, so they can't even go by and talk to him. Mr. Peacock, to correspond with Mr. Boggs, slipped documents under the door of the locked office. He would not communicate with them. Worse than that, he did no work for them. Mr. Boggs talks about, I don't know what I could do. And just take Ms. Dodder's case, for instance. What she hired him to do was open an estate to get the power to use the court to get the information that he needed it, that he needed. 2 years later, there was no estate opened. And when he couldn't get return phone calls, what was Ms. Dodders to do? In Mr. Peacock's case, Mr. Boggs admitted on my cross-examination of him on record that he was spending all this time, allegedly, looking at decisions that had been rendered in 01 and 02 when he knew he couldn't do anything about them. We're not talking about an ability to file a 60B or do something out. He's effectively wanting us to believe that he billed this guy $4,000 for looking at closed cases. He couldn't define what his scope was. Mr. Peacock was, and I think as the panel found, a compelling witness that all he wanted was help. He paid $4,000 that he didn't have and got no help. Mr. Boggs has had the help of a monitor. And Justice O'Donnell, it was for almost precisely the same trust account violations as you see today. I know. I prosecuted him that time, too. He just doesn't get it. He does not understand and cannot produce records that he's required to reconcile his trust account with a bank statement. In fact, he does know reconciliation, and the record reflects that the only thing he came up with here in the way of a trust account is minimally listing a client and what happened to the money when I withdrew it, which in most cases was immediately after it was presented.
I think we understand the significance of the impact on the clients and the conduct. And the panel came out with a recommendation for a 2-year suspension with a 1-year stayed and the imposition of a monitor. But the board increased that to an indefinite suspension. What would be, in your view, the justification? As I look back, I don't know that Mr. Boggs has ever been suspended.
I can answer that, Your Honor.
All right.
Plain and simply, it doesn't reflect fully in the transcript. Mr. Boggs was pitiful at that hearing. And I mean pitiful not in the context that he did a terrible job representing himself, which he in fact did, but I mean pitiful in the context that you could not watch, particularly his closing argument, with anything other than pity. And I think that what happened is that the panel did feel sorry for Ken Boggs. But I think that pity was not justified. And I think the commissioners got it right. When we look, and I don't know, maybe that's not what they did justice, but that was the only reason I could see why the penalty was not more severe there, particularly when this is his third go-round.
But what case do you rely on that we could look to that might be comparable to justify
I think Wise.
One penalty or another?
I think Wise. Your Honor, and I would say, too, that Mr. Boggs cites McShane, and that the guy had prior discipline and had a medical problem. He recites Cook, who had a prior discipline. He recites Volksberger, who had a CLE suspension. Those aren't even comparable to what we're dealing with here when we've got the practice. I guess I've misarranged this for the other cases here, but the reality is we know that the substantial duty of this court is to protect the public from bad lawyers. Ken Boggs is a bad lawyer. It's time to set him down. Each of the previous cases, if you'll note, he had a public reprimand and then a discipline by consent that we agreed to a suspended sentence to cure exactly the same problem we got back here. He just doesn't get it. Whether there was a good reason or not for the panel to recommend what they did, Justice O'Donnell, the commissioners got it right because when you step back and look what happened here and the virtual thefts that occurred, there is no other justification to do anything but the indefinite suspension. And I would ask this court also to make that suspension, the reinstatement, if he ever applies, conditioned on a couple things. One is, of course, restitution to Mr. Peacock and Ms. Dodders. Second is restitution to any other clients that apply to the client as security fund as a result of the actions that have taken place in this time frame. And then thirdly, he certainly has got to get some law office management education before he ever should even be able to reapply. Unless the panel has further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Close. Mr. Boggs, do you have anything in reply?
If you look at the McPeak case, he came to my office in November of 07. He didn't pay me a dime until January of 08. I had worked all that time. His hearing came up, I think, with the arbitration panel in late February, early March. I had helped prepare that and try to get his job. He makes a deal about me looking at his old disciplinary cases. It's the same thing that you look at my disciplinary cases here. When he gets the arbitration panel, they need to determine what to do with him if they find he did misconduct, because they can either fire him and uphold that, or give him a suspension without pay, or give him a fine of some kind. That's the same thing here. That's why I had to know what he'd done in the past, because he didn't tell me. He said, I had a problem, da-da-da. I said, well, when we get the arbitration, they'll know about it, because that's the first thing I'll talk about. I'm not proud of anything. I did not intend to harm anyone. I would never harm anyone.
What about the lady with the estate? You were to open. How much money did she give you?
She gave me $9,700, and I worked.
And when did she give it to you?
January 26th or 27th of 2006.
And when did you open the estate?
We never did, Your Honor, because as I told her when I met her at her house two times before she paid me the check, I explained to her, until we can find this woman, because she admitted in the hearing, too, that her dad has no assets for an estate. What she was hoping to do was punish this woman to get back the car that her dad had, but we couldn't find the woman or the car. We couldn't find any other assets. So I said, there's no sense opening up an estate to chase this woman and get her in front of someone for a deposition or anything, because we have to find her first. So when we find her, then you open up the estate. You don't put the cart before the horse.
So you took $9,700 to look for somebody?
I sent letters out to the woman. The record shows I sent letters out to her, they certified letters. I sent regular letters. I went to the house. I staked out the house. I had investigators working with me, taking turns watching the house, hoping we'd catch her. We went to her daughter's, this woman's daughter's house, hoping she might be there babysitting so we could catch up with her. I did find that she had a traffic ticket because she had no license, and they impounded the car, and then the car disappeared. So I couldn't get anything else from the car. My investigators worked with me. Bob Britt, who's a homicide detective for Columbus, he worked his butt off trying to help me find this woman. He still has helped me try to find this woman. Like I told Ms. Dars, I haven't given up trying to find her, even though this situation is going on. I gave her my word that I'd try to find this woman. As soon as we do, I'll notify her, and then maybe we can do something with her. At this point in time, till you have the person who's got this alleged car and maybe some assets, your wife started a case that you can't do anything with. And I didn't want to get in that situation. Maybe a statute of limitations was running, because this woman, I haven't been able to find her. I found the traffic ticket once. She didn't go back to court, so there's a warrant out for her arrest.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Boggs.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter. You'll be notified of our decision.